21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
My shoes are worn out, walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change. And I get the strangest feeling as I'm heading for the light.
Well, that's not quite your host. That's the Traveling Wilburys there. It really is. And Bob Dylan's in that group. Did you know that? Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, your host this evening, and our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Courtner, our engineer tonight, who's running this train at 475 miles an hour. Once again, is Noah Dankner. And, well, we had a great time at the Leon Day 100th birthday party yesterday. At the Babe Ruth Museum, thanks to the hard work of Michelle Freeman and her group of friends and family that pulled this off, we were able to honor my old friend, the Negro League legend Leon Day, who finally made it into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 1995, just 6 days before he died. Thank you to the Baltimore Sun and especially Dan Rodericks for his column and podcast on Saturday, and to Mary McCauley for her terrific article in the Baltimore Sun this morning, and to Carl Merton Farron for his very touching video included as part of that article online. And thanks to them, we had close to about 100 people turn out and enjoy birthday cake and baseball stories and snacks and participate in our silent auction and sales table, where we raised even more money for the West Baltimore Youth Baseball Leagues, keeping alive the integrity and grit and resilience of the old Negro League baseball leagues, and inspiring that sportsmanship in a new generation. For information at leonday.com, leondayfoundation.org, I highly recommend you support this worthy foundation. Now, you better hold on to your hats, friends, because this is going to be a rollicking show that we've got prepared for you tonight, and we're going to challenge all kinds of your assumptions. So get ready to test your limits. For the first hour and a half, we'll be talking to the husband and wife partnership team of Dr. Andrew and Celeste Gurevich from Portland, Oregon. They are going to tell us how to break out of the patriarchal and materialistic mindset that has hypnotized our society into patterns of perpetual war and strife. And at the end of the show, our old friend Rebecca Hofberger will return to tell us about the new exhibit that just opened at the American Visionary Arts Museum, which is called Yum, History and Fantasy and Future of Food, and that sounds delicious. Professor Andrew Gurevich is a teacher of writing, mythology, literature, religion, and philosophy. His works have appeared in Popular Archaeology, The Ecologist, Anthropology of Consciousness, The Voice, Reality Sandwich, and many others. He has been featured in the books Indonesian Tribal Art, Jesus, Muhammad, and the Goddess, and the Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Celeste Gurevich is a multimedia artist, a self-proclaimed bird nerd, and a hiking enthusiast who grew up on the Central Oregon coast, and her work has been published in Perceptions, a magazine for the arts, and The Manifestation, and elsewhere. She is a popular performer and active on social media. Together, Andrew and Celeste produced the erudite podcast called On the Block Radio, where their motto is, this is a great motto, quote, "We talk to smart people so you don't have to." That's right. All right. End quote. Their program is designed around listening, engaging, and transforming. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Andrew and Celeste Gurevich.
Bob, it's absolutely delightful to be with you.
Hi, Bob. Great to be here.
Are you guys sitting up straight?
Yes, we are, sir.
Okay, now, you're allowed to talk, but you're not allowed to chew gum, so, you know.
You know, I got to say, after that intro, I think we should just, like, go to commercial and fade the show out. I don't know if I can live up to the stuff.
Well, you got to. You got to.
Fair enough. We'll do our best.
We've already paid for this show, so you got to do it. That's the way it goes.
Fair enough.
Well, as you know, we've been following your work for several years now after discovering your article called In Goddess We Trust, America's Spiritual Crossroads, that was very helpful. To say it was very helpful is a total understatement. I just love that article so much. As a matter of fact, in my diary that day, I wrote it down in big letters, in about 2-inch letters in my diary, that this I love this piece. Okay, well, enough of that.
By all means, continue.
All right. Well, it helped us in preparing for our own book called Secret Life of Lady Liberty, Goddess in a New World. Obviously, our mutual love of the American goddess and the absolute necessity to embrace her now is full on and is what we want to spend most of our time talking about with you. But first, let's lay a little groundwork. Andy, I read in one of your longer bios that while finishing your master's work in biblical theology, you had a series of transformative experiences that led you to, quote, renounce the experiential detachment and institutionalized hierarchy of the patriarchal religions and embrace a path of discovery in the archaic integrative wisdom traditions. Now, I'm curious about this series of transformative experiences that flipped. What was it that flipped the switch for you? What happened?
Wow, well, that's a great question and a great place to start. So I was a working evangelical fundamentalist Christian pastor, and I was in seminary studying biblical theology and studying Greek and Hebrew. And the answer to this question really comes from three areas. In my personal life, I had always had a very tragic and very broken and very violent relationship with my own family and my own mother. And so my disconnection from my mother and from that relationship and from any kind of nurturing interaction with her kind of has always stoked this awareness of a void of connection to the sacred feminine in my own life. But then as an academic, as a scholar, it really came from a couple of places. One was the social issues. And so while I was sort of religiously conservative, socially, when it came to discussing issues of reproductive choice or of LGBTQ marriage or of science and evolution, I found myself with far more progressive ideas that lent themselves more towards a kind of progressive brand of Christianity than I was currently participating in. And one that had more egalitarian views towards women. But theologically, it really came from two places. I was in a conference once, and they were discussing the book of Proverbs, and they were discussing the very important passing on of wisdom in the Hebrew tradition and how it was codified in the book of Proverbs as a father giving wisdom to his son, right? And that this wisdom is in the Hebrew personified as Sophia. And so I remember asking the speaker about the sort of feminine face of Hebrew wisdom in that discussion. And he looked at me like I was from Mars, right? Or that I was a heretic. I mean, the whole room just turned and had nothing to say. And more than they had nothing to say, I was sort of shunned for even asking the question. Mm-hmm. And so that led me into a personal, like a sort of biblical exegesis, a study of the text myself, that led me to two really fascinating places. One has to do with what the early rabbis said about the very beginning of the text in the book of Genesis. But the other has to do with two of the earliest bits of scripture ever written. And one of them is the poetry in the book of Job. And this is Job chapter 38 and following. And the book of Job is written, the story part of Job was written during the Babylonian captivity to sort of explain to righteous Jews why they were suffering in captivity and that God hadn't turned his back on them or their covenant. But the poetry part is some of the earliest Hebrew scripture ever written. And in it, Yahweh is sort of boasting to no one in particular that he is the one who bound the sacred waters. He is the one who loosened Orion's belt. He's sort of taking credit for what Marduk takes credit for in the Babylonian creation story, which is stepping in and seizing power from this sort of shadowy, benevolent, sacred feminine figure and taking that power for creation and destruction for himself. And the second piece of scripture that I found interesting is in the book of Judges. And this is the Song of Judith, which is the first piece of scripture written, as far as we know, in terms of the Hebrew Bible. And this is a female judge. And the judge was a, you know, somebody that was, you know, part president, part governor, part general, part warrior. The judges were the sort of one-size-fits-all ruler of the community. And early Israel had a female judge, and she was her name was Judith. And in her song, she's giving her authority and calling the people in prayer to serve Yahweh. And so I started to see in the early biblical text this notion that there was, prior to its existence, this sacred feminine wisdom that the biblical story was trying to set itself on top of. And lastly, as so frequently happens when a dominator culture tries to lay itself over the top of something that came before it, you try to erase all evidence of that thing that you're trying to replace. And so the very first letter in the Hebrew, in the book of Genesis, is Bereshit, part of the word. It's the B, basically, in Hebrew. And the way it's facing, in terms of the text going right to left, it's closed to the right and then open to the left. And the early rabbis said very clearly that letter, the Hebrew Bible, starts with a closed revelation, that everything to the left of it, meaning everything from its opening revelation forward, was a part of what God's people could discuss and meditate on, but everything before it must not be discussed. And so that prohibition and the clear absence of equity in the church in terms of gender and their understanding and connection to the earth and to women's rights, it just led me out of practicing the religion the way I had been and into a whole new path of discovery.
Well, thank you for that insight, too. I was going to be a priest, and the Dead Sea Scrolls changed everything for me, and then other materials found, which indicated to me that we didn't know the whole story about Jesus at all, and that's what we have today, especially within the extremist Christian groups who have no idea that there were other gospels, that et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it changed me forever. Now, let's get that balance from the other side. Celeste, you reveal a lot about your own personal transformative experiences in your poetry.
Well,
but I'd like you to also hear if you had any defining moments where the lights came on for you and you realized that reality is not what we're conditioned to believe by the media and in school, or have you always been a courageous seeker of insight?
Wow. Well, I think a lot of it has actually been innate in me since I was a very small child. My uncle, my mother's brother, had jumped bail as a conscientious objector and went up to BC, Canada. And so I was raised partially as a very young child up there on Vancouver Island with the native communities, and also went on the Central Oregon coast. There is a tribe called the Siletz that is in my hometown of Lincoln City that I had very close contact with during those formative years as well. And also a bit of a young, single, neglectful mother who kind of left me on my own enough so that I got to run around in the forest with my friends and on the beaches and just kind of learn from nature itself. And so my mother was also very political and taught me politics from a young age. And so I never really had that blanket, blinded, you know, view of this culture, and really started seeking out on my own very early the whys and wherefores of how the whole thing was set up. And I just came across so many injustices and double meanings and, you know, contradictory ideas and truths that I just never really aligned with. And so my path has always been kind of off trail, I would say, for that.
Would you say nature played a major part in this?
Yes, I have a line from one of my poems that says, "Nature was better parents to me than my own ever were." And really, I've the core of what I know I've learned from nature, and still to this day, what I know to be truest about this world is taught to me by animals.
Wow. Wow. Boy, it took me a long time to understand that animals were far more intelligent than I ever thought. It's quite embarrassing. It really.
Well, it's conditioned. We're taught that. Yes, it's such a, you know, that's such a formulated idea to think of animals as sort of furniture, you know, not as their own sentient beings. But just like young children, you know, I think they're the wisest teachers that we have.
Well, my wife, Dr. Zahara, taught me about that and really changed my life radically. I think we need to take a break here. Is that true? We do. Nope. We're taking a break here. Sit up straight now. And you can chew gum right about now. Our guests are Dr. Andrew Gurevich. I got it right this time. I corrected my mistake. And Celeste Gurevich. In Goddess We Trust, America's Spiritual Crossroads, and Forgotten Wisdom of the Chaveau Cave, and Becoming My Own Midwife and Other Nuggets of Wisdom. Check them out on ontheblockradio.com.
This is Rian Eisler. I'm the author of The Chalice and the Blade, The Real Wealth of Nations, and other books, and president of the Center for Partnership Studies. And I've just done an interview with Dr. Bob Hieronymus for 21st Century Radio, and I've really enjoyed it. So I encourage you to listen. And I also encourage you to go to our website, partnershipway.org.
Now, she taught me a lot about the Partnership Way. Boy, I have so many mentors. I think I have more mentors than anybody else. Maybe 32,562, I think there is. Oh, gosh. Even ants have been my mentors. No joke. Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Our guests are with Dr. Andrew Gurevich and Celeste Gurevich in Goddess We Trust, America's Spiritual Crossroads, and boy, are we at a crossroads. And Forgotten Wisdom of the Chauvet Cave. Sounds
Chauvet.
Like Chauvet, like Marie Chauvet.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, it must be French then. And
pathologically so, yes.
Becoming my own midlife. Hey, we better get to work here. You're not supposed to have a good time. We're supposed to get serious here. Now, before we launch into our discussion of the goddess and why her symbolism is crucial to humanity's survival, I want to ask Celeste to tell us about her poem that she wrote about our football team in Baltimore called The Ravens. So she's a big Ravens football team guy here. No, seriously. It's not literally about our football team. It's about there. So there really were Ravens before our football team. And I wonder how they did tonight. I hope they didn't lose their fifth one in a row.
Oh,
now,
wow.
We did?
Oh.
Oh, okay. Well, it's about this powerful symbol of the Ravens. So let's tell us about this poem that is actually about Edgar Allan Poe's Raven.
Yes, well, it's kind of a funny story. It was really a one-off for me as in terms of what I had been writing, subject material. I had been asked by some close friends to be a part of something called the Poe Show that was celebrating Poe's birthday, and it was an event held at a place called the Clinton Street Theater, which is a beloved older theater in town that hosts all sorts of events. And so I needed to write. It was just anything inspired by Poe. There was music and performance art and actual visual art and writing and readers. And so I wrote, I needed to write something. And so I just kind of sat one day and meditated on my connection with Poe. And it was really minimal. I always thought he was too wordy and kind of, you know, Edwardian slash Victorian for me, lots of grandiose, you know, flourishes of adjectives and things. And so I was like, well, what do I connect with most? And it was actually the raven in the story and the fact that I'm obsessed with crows and ravens. And so I thought, well, you know, let me go back and read the raven and see, you know, what my hit is now looking at it from the raven side. And man, he got the short end of the stick in that poem. And he just, you know, all he says is nevermore. He has this kind of menacing personality. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll just see what comes out of me if I go to the raven's point of view and what he would say to Poe now if he actually could speak back to him about this very famous poem and the representation in that poem of the raven. And so that's what came out of me was this piece. And I called it The Raven Speaks Redo, R-E-D-U-X. That's pretty much the story.
Well, you know, this, of course, reminds me of our discussion with Ian Begg, which we'll get to right after you tell us the story.
Okay. So, the poem, The Raven Speaks Redo. Dude, we have got to clear up a few things here. First, I flew in your window because it was freezing outside. All I wanted to do was dry my feathers in front of the hearth, but your damn cat was already there. Did I hear you call the beast Cat Arena? For real? And you call yourself a writer. Second, you're lucky I didn't fly down off that bust, because I would have done exactly this. Landed on your shoulder and plucked at your mustache. Gone for the shiny buttons on that metal machine that clackety-clacks words onto paper. Then the papers next to it, the whole stack. Toss them and shred them for my nest. Your fat feline saved the day, my friend. Trashing that room would have been a riot. Mr. Poe, did you know that ravens have eyesight to rival an eagle's? I wanted to pick at your hair, dark as my feathers, but no shine, and eat the lice in there. And no wonder you have them. Take a bath, man, seriously. You stink all the way to the ceiling. I eat dead things, and it made me want to barf. Mr. Poe, did you know that ravens have a sense of smell to rival a Labrador's? I'll bet the answer is no based on this. You made me look like a deplorable idiot in your little story. I mean, listen to a few of your descriptions. Ungainly, ominous, ghastly. Ghastly? How rude. Lastly, what offends me the most, Nevermore. Are you kidding me? How the bloody hell did you get at Nevermore from Grok, Grok? Use some Q-tips after that bath, bro. A suggestion for you, Poe, Mono a Raven. You are a weird, sad little man. Lay off the sauce and do some pre-writing research next time.
Very good. Way to go. You know,
I think she's a little tough on the guy. I mean, I just want
to
say
well,
that.
Well, he needed to be
fans,
tough
but...
on. I mean, he well, he did need a bath. He did. I mean, there are a lot of things about him that could have been improved in one way or the other.
Fair enough.
Could have, you know, however, you know, I'm telling you, ravens and crows, birds, I just love birds. I don't think I've ever seen a raven, but we got a lot of crows, and I understand just how they are so smart.
Yes, they are.
Once again, you know, this is something that I had to have mentors for, because they are one of the, not only so smart, they're one of the smartest of all birds, and there are a lot of smart birds.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, I'd love to interject a little bit into that.
No, you can't. You can't. No, what are you gonna interject? Come on.
Oh, I was just going to say, just to tie in something you were talking about with Celeste before the break. You know, there's an author, Michael Pollan, who wrote a book called The Botany of Desire. And in it, he just tries to talk about several relationships that humans have with plants, but from the plant's perspective. And it got us to talking and thinking about things like eco-psychology, which use the terms and the structures of psychology to talk about humanity's relationship with the earth. But this new form of a field called terrapsychology is doing the same thing. It's trying to study that relationship not from the human side, but from the side of the earth. Mm-hmm. And when you were asking Celeste about growing up in nature and learning from nature, I was watching a program on Vice earlier, and there was a woman who was traveling around, and she was in Scotland, and they were teaching her how to hunt. And she said, "Oh, I'm a woman. I'm probably not going to do well." And the man said, "On the contrary, when novices come here and learn, women tend to do better because they're good listeners. The men that come think they know how to do everything already, and the women listen." Mm-hmm. And it made me think about women who listen to the earth, and especially an earth that's in peril. If women are better listeners, which they have been for millennia, they're also starting to speak, and they're starting to speak loudly and in unison about what the earth is telling them.
That's yes. I had another mentor number 3500, was a guy named Chris Bird, who wrote The Secret Life of Plants.
Oh, yes. Right.
Remember that guy? He was Dr. Zahara and my best man at our wedding.
No kidding.
He was just terrific. He had great time. You know, he was OSS and then CIA.
Wow.
Yeah, and he was the guy that told me all about that it was already known in the 70s that we were in deep doo-doo, and that even though it would be warming for a while, that we would be moving towards extreme cold. Mm-hmm. And that, to them, was more fearful than getting warmed up, even though, as we hit 127 degrees out there in Oklahoma, roasting the ground so the plants can possibly... Oh, I've got to stop. I'm sorry. I got carried away. But anyway, that was another mentor. And we all have them. I'm sure you guys had a few mentors, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Now, yes, sir. How do you like that? I got the first time I've ever been called sir. Anyway, now, here's a quote from Andy's article in Goddess We Trust that I want to use to launch us into this discussion. Quote, "New research in neuropsychology, evolutionary biology, and child development has shown that Western civilization has been suffering from a several thousand year long hallucination. Many of these scientists are claiming that for a number of reasons, we have become a dangerously left hemisphere dominant society. Modern civilization is suffering mightily from this extreme dominance of the rational intellectual mind," end quote. Now, this is a very important point. The heavy imbalance into scientific materialism has poisoned us to even consider our spiritual selves or synchronicities or messages from spirit animals. So I'd like you guys to elaborate.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the first thing I think is I need an editor to make me less verbose. But, you know, this concept is an important one as well. And there's several theorists that come to mind. The first is a guy named Leonard Schlain that I'm not sure if you're familiar with. Right. But he wrote a very important book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess.
Oh, yes.
That's been really dismissed, I think, unfairly by a lot of folks. In the anthropological community and other places. But Schlain's basic premise was that since the dawn of civilization, since we created linear writing systems, that we've been sort of soft wiring our brains to be more left hemisphere dominant, and that along with that, attendant with that, that as we've developed industrial agriculture and the systems of banking and warfare to attend to that, that we've pushed ourselves into this entirely materialistic view of matter, right? And we've been sort of stuck in that place for damn near 7,000 years. But you know, Schlain isn't the only person at the table. There's a couple of people that have really been doing some interesting work, and it really has to do, as you mentioned in the quote, with neuropsychology. So I'm thinking of three names: Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor and her wonderful TED Talk and her book, A Stroke of Insight, where she talks exactly about this as a psychologist studying her brain from the inside when she actually lost part of her left hemisphere while she was having a stroke, and speaks to the awareness that she is able to achieve of the sort of two selves that exist within her, and through the corpus callosum, which is much thicker in women, by the way, she's able to navigate back and forth between those hemispheres and those two ways of seeing. The other two theorists I'll mention are Ian McGilchrist, who wrote an amazing book, and he has a TED Talk as well called The Divided Brain that speaks exactly to this. And then lastly, Jeremy Rifkin's Empathic Civilization. And all of them are saying the same thing, that the systems, our banking systems, our educational systems, our legal systems, our linguistic systems are all built on enshrining the same ethos. And it's an ethos that no longer serves us. And it's one that was utilitarian for a conquest mindset, but no longer can the world stand on that footing. And for us to move off of that footing, we have to move back to a relationship of parity among the genders, and then between ourselves and all non-human species, brothers and sisters on the planet, and indeed with the cosmos itself. And if we're, and as Rifkin, I think, rightly says, if we can't envision that and then start to deprogram and reprogram ourselves into those categories, then we got a real rough ride ahead together.
We got a very rough ride together. Mm-hmm. Because
in my estimation, is the goddess is the most efficacious symbol in getting us there, regardless mm-hmm. of someone's religious or political or cultural background. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, Celeste, do you believe in that stuff?
Quite. I have always been the rabble rouser that went around when it wasn't as popular, telling, you know, hardcore Christians about how their holidays were just really stolen holidays, and tell them exactly what the natural, you know, the cross quarter holidays and Brigid, and I would go off on all of the, you know, the alternative quote unquote knowledge that I knew. I've been studying many, I guess you would say pagan identified, primarily women since I was a teenager back in the 80s, as much as I could get my hands on the cultural wasteland of the Central Oregon coast back then. But it's my core belief is that all of this conditioning that's happened over the past 7,000 years has served to actually make us forget that we are more similar than we are different. And I think that that's just a fundamental truism about the world that yeah. all of the you know, the people that I've followed continuously and would consider mentors, really at the bottom of their philosophy, that's it's humanitarianism, you know, and there's equity in that we need to get back to on balance, or we have no chance of coming together and even beginning to have conversations that will lead us to solutions.
You know, it's going to sound kind of corny in a way, but it's more or less like what was set up at Woodstock. We are one.
Yes, absolutely.
I elaborated on that as we are one people on one planet. Mm. And we're eventually going to get there unless Mother Nature decides that it needs different carriers,
yes.
different people here, because she's had it. She's had it with us. Mm-hmm. And it's going to cause some serious changes. Now, that sounded nice, didn't it? I mean, it's not,
yes,
it's telling the truth, but in a nice way.
It
you
is.
Know, waves coming in at 600 miles an hour, about a couple hundred feet high. What are you going to defend? How are you going to defend anything against that? But we got some uninterested. Well, let's just stop that. Now, you, I got to get out of that. You noted that the Native Americans recognized this mental illness right away among the first Europeans. They called it, I guess it's pronounced Wetiko.
Yes,
Wetiko
or Wetiko. I have a dear friend. Yeah.
Hey, wait a second. Let me talk here a second.
Sorry.
So, okay, I was wrong. It's Wetiko. All right. Which literally means, listen to this, friends, cannibalism, but in essence means an unsustainable dominance that requires violence to continue. Wetiko means you will consume the life force of others for profit without giving back something from your own life. No reciprocity or respect. Now, how does that translate in today's situation?
Boy, howdy, where to start? You know, I wrote the Goddess article. I wrote the Columbia article based on something, a conversation I had with the radio host, Tom Hartman.
Oh, good man.
Who's just a wonderful guy. And he talks about this on the air regularly. And he was talking about when you go to D.C., the District of Columbia, that when you go around to all the different federal buildings, you see these female statues either on top of the building or in front of it. And in my conversation, I added Libertas. I added the goddess aspect that's in New York Harbor. And we could go off in the weeds on this, but are different goddesses aspects of the same maternal regenerative principle as people like Maria Gimbutas taught, or do you have to treat each of them separately? And, of course, I would say both and. But I would say in the American goddess tradition, the giant statue in New York Harbor is absolutely connected to that which is on top of most of the buildings in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And what Tom and I were talking about is that the goddess tradition is exactly this, to remind one constantly that this metaphor that, you know, I've heard you say several times, Mother Earth, or the, you know, the Mother Cosmos, is more than a metaphor. We are born out of the earth. We are actually born from its belly and return to it. And because of that, as Celestia said, deep connection to it and to every other living thing, we have a responsibility to it, a familial responsibility. And early peoples manifested this through goddess symbols, right? This was the easiest way to remind people of this sort of larger, the family of all the living. And so even when we, you know, even in the midst of industrial patriarchies, even in the midst of religious patriarchies, the symbolism remains. And when Americans start to sort of envision symbols that can in, that that can speak for their highest values, the purest form of what we want to represent from what, for, to one another and to the rest of the world, we manifest those in a kind of divine feminine.
With that, we got to take a break here on 21st Century Radio. And with our guest, Dr. Andrew Gurvich and Celeste. One of these days I get it all right. But in this incarnation, next incarnation, I'll have it right. Now, in Goddess We Trust, America's Spiritual Crossroads, and Forgotten Wisdom of the Chauveau Cave, like Marie Chauveau, and Becoming My Own Midwife, that is, and other nuggets of wisdom. Check them out on ontheblockradio.com.
This is Elaine Pagels, author of the Gnostic Gospels, and also of a new book called Revelation, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. I'm a professor of religion at Princeton University, and you are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Hey, that's Sister Elaine. Boy, what a good time we had with her. Well, our guests are Andy and Celeste, or if you're left-handed, Celeste and Andy. And
I am indeed.
Either works.
Yeah, either does work. Now, Andy, you write so well. Here's another phrase that I love, but I'm not going to let you answer it. I'm going to ask Celeste to answer this one. All right. You write so well, as I said. Here's another phrase. Over time, the patterns become so pervasive, so reinforced at all levels of the culture that they become the norm. The lunatics forget they are hallucinating. The wheels come off the bus. Boy, I love that phrase. I can see it right now. The wheels come off the bus. How are these patterns of domination and separateness reinforced, and then they're forgotten? Tell us. Listen. Come on, Celeste, tell us.
Wow. Well, that's kind of a top-down to, you know, bottom-up answer, really. I mean, the conditioning starts, you know, through media, especially now, telling us the stories of who we are and deciding for us, you know, the choices we should make and the ideals we should have. You know, I think so much of the focus lately has been on the female experience, lately because of course, the current climate with Mr. Trump and his, you know, triggering women every single day with one thing or another, culturally and societally. But I think we see, you know, it's reinforced in school, it's reinforced in employment, it's reinforced in relationship to government. You know, my own experience as a single mother in the 90s and having to rely on, you know, welfare at points, you know, state benefits, state insurance, and the kinds of stigmas that still come with that. I think that, you know, that reinforcement is woven into every experience we have as Americans, really. And I think that there's a very purposeful, very calculated, very researched and well paid for, you know, set of purposes behind that. And that's to make us easily pliable, ill and dependent on a system that keeps us ill and separated from one another so that we don't begin to have real conversations. We don't share each other's stories with empathy and with shared oxytocin and look in each other's eyes and speak to who we are as human beings. And that's really by design.
Yeah, that certainly is by design. Andy, how do you suggest we help wake up the majority of Americans today who do not realize they are hallucinating?
Yeah, you know, we have a dear friend who's writing a book about her life in South Africa and her family, Lisa and apartheid. And she was just talking with me last night. And she said her mentor, who's helping her write her book, because she's struggling to write about apartheid because she's white. And she said her mentor said, you know, the tyranny of the tyranny of the society is the tyranny of the family. And I thought that was fantastic. And I think we can work that in reverse. The tyranny, when we're talking about how these things become enshrined and normalized, they become normalized the same way they do in abusive families. We acclimate to them out of survival, mm-hmm. And because we don't know any better. And so I think the first thing we have to do is start finding those voices who have been marginalized and who have been abused and who have been silenced, and allowing those to come to the center and listening to them as much as we possibly can. And that means indigenous people, that means women, that means LGBTQ people, because these voices have been silenced for so long, and they've been listening and they've been watching as a certain kind of person has run the society into the ground. And now we have people that, we have so much potential, we have so much connectivity, yet in so many ways we're more isolated from one another than we ever have been before. And so I think the task before us is monumental, but at the same time, the opportunity and the access are there as well. And so how people get woke is first by having a desire to. You know, I have a friend who we just interviewed on the show named Caleb Stevens on our program, and he was talking about how people find out about gentrification and about oppression, about what's going on. And he said something very profound. He said, look, you know, if you can Google porn, you can Google oppression, right? And you know, we can inform ourselves about what's actually happening in the world right now. We don't need to wait, as most people have in the rest of human history, for a priest or a pastor or a professor or a gatekeeper to get us access to true information. We can actually, if we have, you know, an internet connection, and obviously many people don't, we can literally find out for ourselves. And so I think one way people get woke is by having a desire to and then seeking out that information. But more than anything, it's just about rekindling our connection to one another. It's about falling in love with the planet again. And as Celeste said earlier, reminding ourselves of the profound connectivity that we have to each other. And, you know, I really believe that the best way to this is, and I can tell you why I think this, is through this manifestation of the goddess figure. But even the Quran, there's a great verse in the Quran where Allah says, I made you into different nations so that you may know one another.
Yes.
It's this idea that through our differences, we will draw closer and to a shared understanding of the full experience of what it is to be human.
Well, both of you have a great way with words. Andy, I know that you've talked about the failed American experiment. Why failed? Aren't we making more money than ever? Isn't this land the land of opportunity where anyone who works hard can rise to the top 1% and retire to a life of happiness and ease and good health? Isn't that what's really going on?
Yeah, you know, don't we wish that, you know? And you know, to bring back the Wetiko or Wetiko virus you talked about before, one of the ways that Wetiko gets us is that we point at it in other people, and then can focus on its existence in others, and then it disappears in ourselves. And so a Donald Trump appears, and we can all point to the sort of hideousness of the misogyny, of the xenophobia, of the Islamophobia, of all the sorts of things, of sort of rampant capitalism and materialism and all the things we dislike about civilization. It's easy to point to a sort of exaggerated buffoon and point at as dangerous as this person is. It's much more difficult to realize the systems, the cultural and institutional systems that led to his creation. And it's far more difficult to look internally to myself, to where I still exhibit toxic masculinity, to where my privilege is still, I still use it on a daily basis to marginalize voices that are other than my own. It's far harder to find that sickness within. And so I think we're not doomed as a people if we can start having honest conversations about how we got to where we are and how we get out of it. And I do really think that starts with listening to voices that have been made to be silent for too long. And, you know, I've been so fortunate to have, you've been talking about mentors this whole time. So many great mentors for me, whether they be, you know, Susanna Budapest or Starhawk or our dear friend Lydia Yuknovich or many, many others, or even my wife Celeste, who sort of sat patiently and watched me discover all of these aspects of the goddess and the sacred feminine and how they applied to modern culture and our understanding of the world. And, you know, to me, I was excavating these things for the first time. And as far as I knew, I was the first person to ever think these things, right? And there's so many wonderful, patient women in my life sit back and sort of chuckle, as you can hear one now.
As
we discover these things, as we come to this realization. And I think we can do that for one another. You just mentioned that about the American dream. I have so many students who are millennials who, you know, we're horrible to these people. We call them entitled because they dare to want an education that they can afford, and healthcare that they can afford, and a job when they get out of school, and an environment with air that they can breathe and water that they can drink. And because they ask for these things and are willing to work for them as well, we call them entitled. And so this American dream has always been one of diminishing returns, and it's always been one that's a kind of sleight of hand for the privileged and the elite.
Well, we are entitled to have a final break here because the news is coming, and I'm going to close my ears when it comes to the news tonight and until the election is over, because I can't stand what I'm hearing by and large. Our guests are Andy and Celeste. In Goddess We Trust, America's Spiritual Crossroads. Check them out on ontheblockradio.com.
Stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio.
21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus and Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney. The sky ain't blue. It's kind of yellow. You know it's true.
It's so hard to figure what it's all about.
When you're outside's in.
Inside out.
You know, you're listening to 21st Century Radio. I'm the alleged Dr. Bob, in this incarnation anyway. And our executive producer is the alleged Laura Cordner, in her incarnation. And running the board tonight is not Sean Roman. No. What did you say? Of course it's Noah Dankner. He's been with us for years. He knows how to drive this train. And our guests tonight are Celeste Gurevich and Andy Gurevich. If you can pronounce them whatever you want. That's the way I'm going to do it here. And we've got just a half hour to do the best we can with these brilliant souls. I've had too much fun, and fun life shouldn't be this much fun, but it is every now and then. You know, I'm a Virgo and I like to suffer. And boy, do I make other people suffer. Trying to be perfect because impossible. All right, now
the joy kicking and screaming, Bob.
Okay, so this question is going to be for Andy. Andy, let's talk a bit about neural tissue and how habits are formed and can be broken. You quote child therapist and psychological trauma expert Dr. Bruce Perry to say, quote, one of the most important characteristics of both memory and neural tissue and of development is that they all change with patterned repetitive activity. That is so neat. So the systems in your brain that get repeatedly activated will change and strengthen and develop, and systems in your brain that don't get activated won't. What can we learn from this in terms of shifting the consciousness paradigm?
Yeah, you know, what a great question. As you talk about in your wonderful book, The Secret Life of Lady Liberty, Goddess in the New World, The connection to Native American beliefs here is a profound one to me. There's a great indigenous parable that I'm sure we've all heard that goes something like, you know, the human heart is guided by two wolves, you know, hatred and love, or greed and compassion. You know, it's this mix between empathy and ego, and whichever one gets stronger is the one that we feed. Right. And this is the indigenous way of saying the exact same thing, that the things, the patterns that we reinforce, the things that we strengthen within, like that your brain is a muscle like anything else. And those pathways that we reinforce, those pathways that we draw and reinforce early in life through repetitive action, and through repetitive action, including things like ritual and religious traditions, internalized thinking that we get through parenting and television and media and everything else, this starts to create a worldview, a sort of closed loop of how we see and participate in the world. And the more that gets reinforced, the more anything that seems alien to that must be ignored, converted, or destroyed. And so then these oppositional narratives begin in each of us, where the alien other is seen as the threat to this constructed reality that we've been building for a lifetime. Yeah. And so the way to get around that is to realize that life is complex and changing and diverse, and that ultimately we are contingent beings and contingent on one another, that we are all given a little flashlight to shine a little bit of a light onto the cave wall. And when we combine our lights, we get a little bit bigger picture of the cave wall, right? And so if you shine your light and I shine my light, each of us is standing in a different place. Each of us is going to have our own perspective. Each of us has a light that will frame something that it will only be the way we can see it. But if we combine them, then we really start cooking. Then we can start seeing a larger frame of who it is we are and what it is we are and how we can navigate this space together.
Yeah, that, I think that really works. It really does. Celeste, I love your poem, Becoming My Own Midwife. Even the title alone is instructive. I especially love this line where you say, quote, I proclaim my diploma from the Global University of the Self-Educated and the Academy of the Ideal Unlimited Potentiality, end quote. Wow, that's pretty serious there. Now, you write about overcoming the tragedies and fears in your life that have made you what you are. Tell us more about becoming your own midwife, or finding one's purpose and mission in life, which I think is the key.
Yes, I think very much. And, you know, it's been an incredible journey for me. I've really, I broke through out of a writer's block, that was about 10, 12 years long. And so I've just really been writing for the past couple of years as an adult. And what I found was that I was drawn to rewriting these stories that I had told myself, you know, that I'd been given by my family. And I had to re-examine suddenly with these new lenses of empathy and understanding, not just for myself, but also for the people involved or not involved. And through that, the midwife piece was really this sort of declaration and reclamation that came out of me in that huge spurt. I just sat down and I just wrote it all out completely. And it's about to be published in a Girl God anthology by our dear sister friend, Trista Hendren, who is an amazing feminist activist in the world. And it's coming out in a print book called Single Mothers Speak Against Patriarchy. And it was really a piece that came out of me. And the response to it is, I wrote it for myself. You know, I really just wrote that piece for myself and felt like it was declaring this new truth. And actually, you quoted the line that you quoted. It felt like one of the more powerful, mini declarations that I made in that piece, because there are so many of us out here who are still overcoming the social stigma of not having certification from, you know, from academia. And without that, you are treated differently. You are looked at differently. You are not taken as seriously in this culture as we should be, based on, you know, lived experience. And so the midwife piece, most importantly, has resonated with other women. I've heard so much from other women how it it resonates with them, and it gives them an example of permission to rewrite their own story and write their own reclamation pieces, you know? And that's really, for me, the greatest gratification as somebody who writes, period, whether it's poetry or prose form or, you know, spoken word, whatever the form it is. It's about telling my story stories in ways that give other people inspiration to use their voices, evolve their voices, tell their stories. Because I really, truly believe that our stories are the most crucial gift that we have to give one another, because that's what builds empathy. And without empathy, human beings won't evolve. I think we've hit the end of our evolutionary, end of evolutionary stump, if you will. We've sort of reached the end point if we can't make that leap.
Well, you know, the League of the Iroquois, I don't know how many of the Klan members had PhDs. As a matter of fact, I don't think
right.
any of them did. And look what they produced in yes. regards to a founding and establishing back in 1142 A.D.
Mm-hmm.
1142
yes.
A.D., a republic a representative republic, not the first in the world, but my heavens, it lasted very long, longer than the United States, and it worked, mm-hmm. and our founding fathers used them. They threw
yes.
out the Klan mothers and things like that, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But,
absolutely.
You know, that's, I think, a very good sign that the soul is a good teacher. Now,
absolutely.
Let's get to Andy, your article, Forgotten Wisdom of the Chauvet Cave, The Sacred Feminine and the Rebirth of Culture, was the cover story in the March 2013 edition of Popular Archaeology, and it changed the discussion on Paleolithic cave art. What is the Chauvet Cave? And why was its discovery in 1994 so important?
Yeah, wow, what a great question. I'll just say this on that last question. Even the title of Celeste's article, the phrase midwife, is an example of feminine healing and wisdom being kicked aside by the certification process of the physician. Mm. And so even the title itself, midwife, always speaks to me about that process. But Chauvet Cave, there was a Werner Herzog movie several years ago called Cave of Forgotten Dreams. And Celeste and I went to see it in the theater. It was a 3D documentary, and it was about this cave in southern France that's a part of a Paleolithic cave network of cave art that extends really all the way from England all the way into southern Germany and down into Spain. And these caves, the art in these caves are anywhere from 15 to about 30,000 years old. And at the time, the Chauvet Cave was the oldest developed cave art ever discovered. There's since been another cave discovered in Sulawesi in Indonesia that has comparable art and is a little bit older. But at the time, Chauvet was the oldest on the planet. And it had only been discovered in the 90s. And so, you know, as far as mythological exploring of the cave, two figures that I would have loved to have heard their thoughts on it, Joseph Campbell and Maria Gimbutas, they're already dead when the cave was discovered. And we sat there watching the film, and it's a wonderful film for folks who haven't seen it. And there's archaeologists, there's anthropologists, there's art historians, there's historians, there's all these folks talking about the cave and what it means, and they're struggling to interpret it. And the one person who was missing from the discussion was a mythologist. And I started asking around and looking into what was going on in terms of the sort of French excavation of these things. And without going too much into it, because I know our time is short, since the French Revolution, the French have been sort of sticklers for secularism in their scholarship. People get beheaded when you talk about God too much in France back in the day. And so they're very slow going to get them onto a conversation about the mythological themes. They're sort of well into the materialist tradition. Also, what tends to happen with these ancient sites, and this is not just in France, mm-hmm. is that the host country takes a kind of ownership culturally of the site. And so for instance, the Muslim Brotherhood controlling access to the pyramids. And this is difficult because this isn't currently in a Muslim country, but these are obviously not Muslim sites. They predate Islam by several thousand years. And the same thing is true in France. These are not French caves by any stretch of the imagination. There's no such thing as France when these caves occur, but they happen to exist in a place that's currently called France. But it's very difficult to extract the Frenchness from the interpretation. And so in watching the film, I became frustrated in the lack of quality mythological interpretation of the images. And it all goes back to this thing we've been talking about this sort of mother of the animals, that these hunter-gatherer societies lived within partnership relationships, not only with one another, but within the natural world, and living within cycles where they understood, don't take too much, give back. Yeah. Small communities that lived in there were skirmishes, there were difficulties, but no examples of large-scale warfare, no examples of slaves, no examples of people owning one another. When you go back into this time period, all the grave sites are the same size. We don't have wealthy and poor kinds of graves. All the homes are roughly the same size. You just don't see the kinds of divisions that you see later because people are living in service of this larger maternal matrix that they sort of exist within, again, these relational bounds. And so it's not everyone for themselves, and people don't exist in these purely competitive ways, but there's a kind of a symbiosis and a partnership society mm-hmm. to it that it feeds and invests the entire organism. Mm-hmm.
Well, can we take our break early so that we can? No? Okay, all right. All right, so Celeste?
Yes.
Tell us about the constellations of the Big and Little Dipper, or Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, and what they meant to prehistoric people regarding cave bear paintings at the Chauvet Shrine in southern France, dated 32,000 years ago.
Wow. Well, that's Ursa. The bear, the cave bear, is at the top, I think, in my humble and, again, non-academic opinion. The cave bear is at the top of the sacred animals, physically, and also animal representations. Ursa Major is really of the animal world, the Persephone of the animal world, because of the hibernation cycles, because of what they didn't know, I think, scientifically, is the way that bears, what hibernation does to a bear's body, and how our human monks actually try to mimic those things through meditation, you know, those metabolic function changes through meditation. I think that they were aware of that being a physically and spiritually sacred dynamic for an animal. The fact that they would reclaim these cave bear caves that obviously, you know, had signs, remnants left over of cave bear skulls, and there are scratch marks on the walls. I think that incorporating the, you know, Ursa Major and Ursa Minor from the sky was taking the constellations and taking them into a quote unquote underworld that they had created this sacred space in. Because again, it's my non-academic belief that these were ceremonial spaces. You know, people weren't living in them, but they were ceremonial spaces for a myriad reasons in those societies. But I think cave bears in particular, there's sort of an extra sacredness to that particular animal because the female was the most powerful, and the cave bears, of course, we know bears are incredibly powerful, but cave bears were, you know, sort of bear, modern bears on steroids. And so you have this incredibly powerful creature that is also incredibly maternal and goes down into, you know, the cave, the underworld for, you know, the seasons, and then comes back out and returns to the light. And so I think it's just all of those things about that particular animal, I guess, spoke in some way to these ancient humans. And so they put the cave bear at the top of the spiritual ladder, so to speak.
Does that dispel any notion of a Mother Earth, Father Sky belief among the early people, that it was really the great Mother Bear who was the creator and protector of all, and she was a ferocious goddess?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, and I think a couple of things with that, you know, that, you know, and the Mother Earth, Father Sky model exists in many, especially Central and South American traditions, but and also in some Druidic ones. The sun consort, which grows to become the first sort of partner of the mother. You know, the Paleolithic peoples didn't quite have, they had so much knowledge, they had sort of working pharmacopoeias and knowledge of the plant and animal worlds that probably definitely far surpass ours. But one of the things they didn't totally understand, according to many anthropologists, was where babies came from. And so the idea was that it took us a while to figure out that men had anything to do with it, that we contributed any genetic material to it. What was thought early on was that at some point a woman's body would just start clotting up their blood, and then 9 months later, sort of miraculously, a new human would come out. And this was a miraculous process that just happened in women's bodies. And so in cultures that have ancestor worship, if you go back and back and back and back, and you're trying to sort of find the first peoples, first mothers, first principle, that from which all things emerge, you go back to a sacred mother, because you're using this birthing metaphor that you're thinking is coming from this sort of sacred feminine presence. And so I think part of that cave bear thing is this sort of protective, dominant mother, and it blows apart any idea of the feminine presence being weak. Right, or sort of minuscule, because it's massive in that sense. But also this concept of regeneration is a key one as well, in that context.
Well, we got less than 4 minutes left in this segment before we say goodbye.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know. So
I feel like we're just getting started here.
Perhaps, yeah, me, I understand. We should have had 7 hours. Now, what is near the back of the Chauvet cave in a large inner chamber? Obviously, as already mentioned, it's the most sacred section of the site. But what's back there?
Yeah, it's so fantastic. So you get back to this cave, and you know, and when you mentioned in the beginning that the article changed, the direction of scholarship, I was so humbled to be in the popular archaeology, because I'm neither popular nor an archaeologist, and so I was just amazed that they took the piece, and then that it got the response that it got. And the premise that I put forward was simply, when we look at other religious art, we read it in context. You know, when you go to, if you go to the Sistine Chapel, or if you go, inside of a pyramid in Egypt, you read the art as intentional and in context, meaning the images relate to one another and they tell a story. And so as you move through the Chauvet cave, as you go further into it, into the womb of the earth, when you get to the very back, what's hanging, the only feminine form in the cave, is the form of a woman's body, the lower half of a woman's body. And at the top, there's actually a bison. And as you go around the stalactite, it turns into a woman's body. And this is the very most sacred part of the cave. And the idea is that all of these animals in there, these animals of regeneration, whether they be paintings of butterflies or anything that dies and is born again in the same life, it's all pointing back to this place of this sacred feminine entity, this mother, this life giver, who is also the one that provides us with our oxytocin, that chemical, that biochemical reaction that allows us to be protective of that which we love and believe to be ours. Mm. And many scientists, I'll just say quickly, because I know our time is short, have talked about empathy and oxytocin, and they say, wait a minute, you know, they're critical of many of the scholars that I've just been talking about, who have been saying these I believe that mythology and religion, these are algorithms, these are just scripts to help us fire different kinds of symbolic consciousness, and goddess consciousness helps us trigger that empathy script. And some scholars say, wait a minute, you know, when you fire oxytocin, that fires this in-group out-group notion, just like a mother bear will rip you in half protecting its cub because it perceives you as a threat, and it's oxytocin's making it do that. But the answer to that is to go back to what both you and Celeste were talking about at the beginning of this segment, which is we have to get to a kind of cognition that sees the in-group as all of the living, the entire family of the biosphere.
Yes. Yes.
And if that's the in-group, then there is no out-group. The out-group are simply those who oppose that kind of consciousness. Right. Well, and in that sense, then you have oxytocin and empathy working for you to create a very, very strong bonds of equity and balance. And I think that's absolutely what we need going forward.
Equity and balance is really the key. It really is. Look, we're going to have to reschedule you guys for another 2 hours in the months ahead. So
okay.
we've got 10 more, 15 more questions.
Oh, boy.
And
oh,
yes, because we've got to get to the horses, and there's a lot of things we got to get to. Uh-huh. Thank you for joining us. This has been just one great time, and I'm so glad that you guys had the time to share with us to opening up this particular idea. And, of course, it supports the idea that I'm prejudiced for, and that is we are one people on one planet, and eventually we're going to get to work it out internally first before we get it to manifest it physically. But that's the way it usually works.
Indeed.
And let's have 44 women presidents in a row.
No kidding.
Before we talk about equality.
That will just about clean it up for a while. That's exactly what we need. Thank you for joining us.
It's been an incredible privilege to be here and a blessing, Bob. Thank you.
You're very welcome. They're very welcome. Okay, well, joining us very soon, right about now, I hope, for the remainder of the show is, what are you saying? Oops, time out on the playing field. I'm wrong again. We're taking a break, and we'll be right back with Rebecca Hofberger of AVAM.